All right. Hi, everyone. Welcome to Short Stories, Tiny Windows into Other Worlds. My name is Cara Elliott-Ortega. I'm going to be your host along with the three authors we have here. We're going to hear from in a minute. I'm so excited to be sharing this space with you in the beautiful Boston Public Library for Boston Book Festival. And just a quick sentence about me. I'm the Chief of Arts and Culture for the City of Boston. So I manage the Mayor's Office of Arts and Culture. And I'm just extra excited to be here sharing this space because a lot of what we do is support local artists, including writers, artists of all kinds, and really think about how we can build the arts ecosystem here to have a really vibrant city for everyone. So I'm excited to be sharing space with three writers, authors who are also teachers locally and have a footprint here and are a part of that ecosystem. So thanks for having us. And I think we're going to start by just having everyone read, and I'll introduce folks and then ask you to share a little bit of your work. So should we jump in? Okay. To my left is John Fulton, who is the author of four books of fiction, The Flounder and Other Stories, which was a Poets and Writers Page One New and Noteworthy Book Selection, The Animal Girl, which was longlisted for the Story Prize, Retribution, which won the Southern Review Fiction Prize, and the novel More Than Enough, a Barnes & Noble's Discover Great New Writers Selection. His short fiction has been awarded the Pushcart Prize, cited twice for distinction in the Best American Short Stories, and been published in Zoetrope, The Sun, Plowshares, and the Missouri Review, among other venues. He lives with his family here in Boston, where he directs the MFA program at the University of Massachusetts, Boston. Please join me in welcoming John Fulton.
All right, great. Can everybody hear me? Yeah, okay, great. So one of the things I noticed about my new book when I started reading proofs is that I was writing a lot about old people. I had written mostly about adolescents before this. And that surprised me. They're in all the stories, and I'm going to read one that is for my grandfather, A.J. A.J. Was part owner of a pawn shop on the south side of Salt Lake City where I grew up, and the highlight of my Saturdays as a kid was to go down to his pawn shop and sit behind the counter. And he and his partner used to tell stories about getting robbed. So I knew that that might someday work its way into a story. So this one's for AJ, Box of Watches. I'm going to read about into the middle of it. That Friday afternoon in AAA Guns and Jewels, Sean's life flashed before his eyes just as they said it would when you face death. Though it wasn't his death, but his grandfather's that made the events of Sean's 22 years begin to recur as soon as he heard the old man shout, "Go right ahead and shoot me, you little shit." Sean was in the back room on the phone with a woman who was calling from Feed the Children. Most of the people who live on our planet are hungry, and most of those people are infants and children, she'd been saying when Sean heard AJ shout these words, turned around, and froze because of what he saw in the yellow, dirty electric light of the front room. The emaciated customer wielding a Beretta 38, which had, as his grandfather knew even better than Sean did, one of the most unreliable hair triggers of any firearm. The slightest shiver could set this cheap, overbought street weapon off. But this didn't bother the old man in the least. He smiled right into the barrel, then laughed a large, open-mouthed laugh like George C. Scott in Patton. One of AJ's favorite movies ever, because the old man likes stories of contrary heroes who rose above history, who built rockets and shot themselves into space, who settled the American West, who killed Germans and bested Rommel, who did anything other than what AJ had been doing for the last 3 years, which was to die slowly of old age and cancer, melanoma that had spread to his liver, his colon, and finally, and most painfully, to his bones, placing him not at all above history, but deeply and painfully inside it. They'd been robbed in the past, 8 times, in fact, and their rule was always do what the guy with the gun says, no matter what. because, of course, at the end of the day, you wanted to live more than anything else. You wanted to get away with your life as they always had, climbing the stairs after closing time to the one-room apartment above AAA Guns and Jewels where they had shared since Sean was a small boy, the same bedroom and kitchen, the same bathroom and black and white TV, the same record player playing the same records, because AJ didn't see any need to trade up for a flat screen or a CD player, dozens of which they had in the shop below them anyway. For years, they'd listened to Frank Sinatra, Harry Belafonte, Neil Diamond, the Duke, and the Count. AJ liked the big band music best. His eyes soft, he'd say, "Those were the days when people used to dance." You had to know how. You had to learn. You couldn't make it up. They prepared the same meals week in and week out, egg salad, BLTs, grilled cheese, club sandwiches, and on Sundays, steak sandwiches with melted Havarti and martini olives right out of the jar. And sometimes, when Sean was still a boy, AJ might make a Jell-O concoction, the same sort of thing that Madeline, Sean's mother, had often made, because his grandfather seemed to understand how terribly Sean missed her after she had dropped him off at the age of 6 in front of AJ's shop, not even coming inside. The storefront's 2 neon signs, "Money for Guns" and "Cash Fast," flickered at Sean's back, and the wind blew in Madeline's dark hair as she shouted out the car window at him and his grandfather, "You're going to stay with Granddad for a few days, all right?" And neither Sean nor AJ ever expected those few days to become 16 years. Now he was about to lose his grandfather as quickly as he lost his mother. He needed to act, to do something. But the woman on the phone was droning on, was saying, "Just a few dollars every month will make a real difference." And Sean wasn't moving. He was scared as he watched AJ lift his hands above his head, not to surrender, but to show his hoped-for killer. As the old man's shirt sleeves fell away from his shriveled wrists, the tumors splattered like thrown mud over his forearms. "I'm already dead," he shouted. "Do it. Shoot me in the mouth. Please. Right in the kisser. You yellow-faced, dickless, candy ass." And the indecisive kid raised the gun and then put it down. And then raised it and put it down. AJ had always had a passion for cussing, for saying and savoring the profane, cocksucker, shit for brains, asswipe, despite the fact that he had never allowed Sean the same privilege. "Do as I say, not as I do," he always told Sean. Or, more simply, "Don't swear, goddammit." And Sean, who had been a timid and compliant child, obeyed because he feared losing him. During those first few years, he would wake in the dark blue of early morning and expect to see the rumpled sheets of the old man's empty bed across from him, and not, as he always saw, instead, the good, respiring lump of his still sleeping grandfather. Nonetheless, Sean did rebel, did throw fits on occasion, as on the night at the dinner table many years ago when AJ shook his head and said, "Your mother seems to have traded in her horse for good," after which he pointed his fork at himself and added, "How about this horse instead?" Which was when Sean threw his plate of cheesesteak to the floor and shouted that he wanted Madeline back. He wanted her smell of lilacs and soap and tangerine shampoo, even the occasional scent of booze on her that meant she'd have trouble getting herself in bed and even more getting out of it the next morning. But he wouldn't complain. Not even about the men she sometimes brought home. The one who made candy cigarettes, nickels, and dimes appear from Sean's ear was the one he liked best. He just wanted her back. He wanted her soft, tickling fingers and her voice singing, "Hush, little baby." His grandfather had liver spots all over his hands and face, and the stink of cigarettes on his breath and the potent rank of his bowels came all morning from the small bathroom at the back of their apartment. "I don't want you," he shouted. "You're an old man, and you stink. You stink." And AJ said and did nothing, just put his head down and attended to his meat sandwich, remaining silent for the rest of the night, even as he bent his frail body to clean up the steak from the floor. It was clear to Sean then that as tough as the old man seemed, he was, in fact, easily hurt. But what made things still worse was that Sean had struck out at AJ more harshly than ever only a few days before, when his grandfather threw one of his fits, brought on more and more frequently by the pain. They'd been at the breakfast table, and AJ had slammed his spoon down, shouting, "This is my last Wednesday ever, my very last goddamn one. I swear it. I'm done with this day. I'm done with Thursday and the next fucking day, too." To which Sean responded, as he always did, "Please don't say that. Please just eat one bite of your oatmeal." Sean was the horse now, the burst of Beeden, who did all the caretaking, who'd even had to drop out of the state college a few years ago to keep the shop, to take AJ to chemo, and to stay with him for the days afterwards when he was sickest. Oatmeal was on the list of cancer-fighting foods he'd gotten from the clinic. He'd even read on the internet about a woman who'd consumed a pound of oats every day until her tumors had just fallen off her. She'd literally seen the wasted pieces of cancer hit the floor and knew that she was cured forever. And so he'd said, "Please, just eat." Though Sean didn't really believe anymore in miraculous last-minute recoveries, and he saw with every passing day that too much suffering made his grandfather vicious. Instead of eating even one bite of his oats, AJ shoved the bowl aside, poured a generous portion of whiskey in his coffee, and lit a cigarette. "Those things don't help, Granddad," Sean said. "In fact," AJ said, "they usually do help me take a shit, and that happens to be what I need to do right now." And so Sean, as calmly and patiently as any 22-year-old who would rather have been in college calculus than with this dying old man, stood and executed his duty as he did every morning. He walked to AJ to the bathroom, undid his belt and zipper, shimmied his pants and boxer shorts down to his knees, and gently set him on the seat while his granddad shouted, "Take your hand off my cock if you wouldn't mind very damn much not making us feel like perverts, please." It was then that Sean did it, left him on the toilet, and sat out in the living room for 30 minutes, long after AJ started calling through the door, "Are you there? I think I need some help. Sean? Jesus Christ. Please, come." Some minutes later, he added, "I'm sorry, kid." Even then, Sean made himself count slowly to 60 before he hurried into the bathroom to see AJ grasping at the edge of the sink, using it as leverage to stand himself halfway up, his pants down around his ankles, toilet paper flagging out of his backside, and a trail of urine running down his pale leg, marbled with veins, and into his sock. "You left me," he said. And I'll stop there.
Thank you, John. Next up, we have Daphne Calate. Daphne's books include the award-winning novels Russian Winter, Sight Reading, and Blue Hours, and two short story collections, Calamity and Other Stories, shortlisted for the Story Prize, and The Archivist, winner of the Grace Paley Prize. Published in over 20 languages, her work has won fellowships from the Christopher Isherwood Foundation, McDowell, and Yaddo, among others. She lives in Somerville, Massachusetts. Let's welcome Daphne.
Hi. Thank you so much. Thank you for being here. Thank you, Kara, so much for all that you do for culture in Boston. And also, I just want to point out, we're just reading from our own books, but Kara read all of our books, so I'm really grateful for that. So this book, The Archivists, is they're stories that are unified not by a single character, but by the theme of archivism. So each of the stories has characters who are dealing with archives, whether those archives are actual documents, maybe they're memories, maybe they're recipes that somebody's handing down in a family, maybe it's choreography that's held in the body, maybe it's genetic material, maybe it's hoarding, right? Maybe it's a pack rat. So these, to me, are all forms of archivism, and the stories then kind of fit together like puzzle pieces that make sense by the end of the book. I'm going to read from the beginning of a story that's towards the middle of the book. It's called A Guide to Lesser Divinities. Being self-employed, I take very good care of my teeth. Why let U.S. healthcare get me down? The minute I lost my job at the university, I bought a water pick, those rubber-tipped scrapers to get the plaque off, and cinnamon-flavored mouth rinse. Used together, they're quite effective. This all began 3 years ago. I was in my mid-30s, or as some call it, late 30s. And suddenly, friends I'd thought no different from me, procrastinators with credit card debt and unpublished doctoral dissertations and boyfriends they'd eventually have to dump, were in charge of things that mattered. School principals, directors of trade organizations, newspaper columnists opining weekly. Somehow, they had parlayed their quaint obsessions and middling skills into actual professions. One lost friend showed up on all the morning news programs, an authority on online dating. I'd done the online rounds myself before meeting Luis and couldn't understand how what for me amounted to no more than lost time had become, in the case of my old friend, credentials. How had she done it? Or rather, what would it take for me to make that leap, to no longer rent a drafty living room? Is this crackling? I wonder if there's anything I can... Can you do something to make it not crackle, or...?
Might be your earring.
Oh, it's my earring! All right, we're fine now. Hold on, I'm going to take some drink. I was like, I hear something. All right. How had she done it? Or rather, what would it take for me to make that leap, to no longer rent a drafty room in a cruddy apartment and teach 4 classes per semester at a state school in perpetual fiscal crisis, to stop dating a man far too young for me who texted me photos of himself sunbathing? Luis, we'd met at the gas station where I was buying lottery tickets. He was filling his Honda, looking cute in his puffy down vest. When he winked at me, I laughed. Being Luis, he just said, "You've got a great smile." One more reason I take good care of my teeth. I always appreciate an honest compliment, so I handed him a scratch card for his kindness. "Better give me your number," he said, "in case we need to split the winnings." Within an hour, I'd received a text. "This is Luis from the gas station. Sorry to say we didn't win the 50K. I wrote back, "Sorry, kid." He wrote back, "Can I take you to dinner?" Before I could type, "I don't know, can you?" I checked myself. Despite a past event of tragic consequence, I try to be open to what life hands me. "Yes," I wrote, "you may." You see, I still believed language, properly employed, might save our careening planet. It's why I made my bewildered students, who enrolled in my great books classes not by choice, but to grudgingly fulfill their humanities requirement, learn the difference between can and may, uninterested and disinterested, lay and lie. To deny the accuracy of one versus the other, I explained, was a first step toward moral corrosion. I told them how the degradation of language set the stage for ethical misjudgment, that our careful parsing of word choice and allusion were skills to combat despots and charlatans, that the semicolons they so blithely misused might be the last feeble shims propping up our teetering republic. They seemed to find this amusing. How could such trivialities matter when they were each working 2 jobs and the babysitter hadn't turned up? They ranged from 18 to 70-something, from a new single mother to a Gulf War vet. Their daily struggles could not be remedied by grammar. Some would disappear mid-semester, then reemerge a year later, without explanation. One woman's family was hiding from the Albanian mafia. The 70-something was connected via clear tubes inserted into her nostrils to an oxygen canister seated intently on the floor beside her. I knew I couldn't solve their problems, but I could try to provide tools for a better life. The future is in your hands, I'd say, conjugating on the whiteboard with my one precious dry erase pen, while the younger students tittered at Lade versus Lane, words fading into nothing as the ink ran low. Please, I'd say, think how happy you'll make me if you remember just one thing I taught you. I was reading my students' homework in the office I shared with two young serfs, or as the university called them, adjuncts, when the program director, Allison, came bustling in. I dislike the word bustle, that its implied petty clamor is reserved solely for women, but it is exactly the word for Allison's click-clacking speedwalk along the corridor. She has the most amazing shoes. Eliana, she set her hard green eyes on me and asked if I would please see her in her office. I pretended to be deciding, while the younger of the serfs looked terrified. He didn't know about my long-standing adversarial relationship with Allison. That to simply do as Allison asked would have toppled our sense of world order. Allison was a tyrant of the micromanaging type. Each semester she insisted on personally approving each professor's syllabus, and every few months would come up with some new pedagogical imperative, usually mass emailed at 3 a.m. and requiring a new mandatory teaching sequence that messed up everyone's class plans. I'd learned to never open these emails, but the young serfs would read them and fall into a tizzy. When I once suggested we discuss these matters as a department, Allison reminded me that until I published my doctoral dissertation, I was lucky to have a full-time salaried and renewable contract. The subject I wanted to teach was the topic of my dissertation, the role of the minor gods in seminal Greek creation myths. But each time I broached this with Allison, she said she needed me to stick with great books. A professor of American culture, she was known for her alarmist op-eds critiquing American literacy, which was perhaps why, some years earlier, she had been named Director of General Studies. Then, a 3 a.m. missive had arrived, addressed not to Jen Studd, but to ALFAC, announcing that while she had for years been fearful of sharing her full truth, she now believed that, despite the risk, it was time she revealed herself as a devoted goddess worshiper and witchcraft practitioner, as she was now shifting her academic focus to this key aspect of her spiritual and social self, and that despite the history of persecution, she hoped for our full support. Included were two web links, one to an explanation of her religion, another to an article concerning the activities of her local coven. As if we didn't already know she was a witch, said our chauvinist colleague Rick, who, when I first joined the faculty, kept mistaking me for our office assistant and asking me to make his photocopies. Rick's comment about Allison went ignored, partly because everyone was fearful of saying anything, but mostly to avoid Rick. I wish desperately my best friend Nisi were there. She would be as enraged as I was that Allison could shift her academic focus to her goddess while preventing me from teaching mine. And I knew Nisi, too, would see Allison's message as a play for sympathy by a rich, white, straight, able-bodied, thin, blonde woman. History of persecution, my foot, cried the Jew in me, whose mother's family had been wiped out in Europe not so long ago. To Rick the chauvinist, I simply pointed out that Allison had always been officious and insufferable. It was to Luis, later, that I voiced my true feelings. But when I described Allison's attempt to define herself as marginalized and become newly relevant, Luis, who taught music at a middle school one town over, said maybe she really did feel she had to hide it. and it was weighing on her. This was on our second date, at a mediocre bistro where no one would be in a hurry for our table. Luis had used the word iterative twice. Even aiming to impress me, he seemed unnervingly laid back. I mean, Luis said, she might come from a background where being a witch is as bad as devil worship. Maybe she grew up in a conservative family and what she's doing is a huge sacrilege. So for her, even just admitting it is daring, risky, frightening. I said, she made it sound like she was equating her feelings of otherness with what truly marginalized groups go through. Well, I mean, you never know another person's feelings. Luis, come on. You should be incensed by this. He gave me a steely look. I should? I stared into my wine. Not to mention, I mumbled, the abuse of all faculty email. He waited a moment before saying in a flat voice, you're funny. When I'd stopped feeling like a jerk, I said, really? Doesn't everyone have personal stuff they'd feel better about if everyone else had to deal with it too? Yes, yes they do. But we don't go around sending email blasts. Well, what about you then? Luis asked, what hidden truth would your email blast say? Before I knew what was happening, my eyes had welled, my heart shredding. I gulped from my water glass, pretending I'd bitten into a chili pepper. When I'd regained my composure, I said, I guess I'd have to tell them I'm a heathen. Before he could press for more, I asked Luis what his message would say. Looking disappointed, he said, maybe I'll tell you later. Fair enough. Then he perked up. Also, aren't you overlooking the most important part of your boss's message? What's that? The woman's a witch. She can do spells and shit. Well, then why did she even need to use all fac email? I'll stop there.
It's frustrating to not just hear the rest of the stories. I'm just going to say, I keep forgetting that we have to keep going. last but not least, Shubha Sunder is the author of Boomtown Girl, a story collection that won the 2021 St. Lawrence Book Award and was a finalist for the Flannery O'Connor Prize for Short Fiction. Her writing has appeared in places like Catapult, The Common, and Narrative Magazine, and has been shortlisted for Best American Short Stories. She has received fellowships from the Massachusetts Cultural Council, the Boston Mayor's Office of Arts and Culture, and the Corporation of Yaddo. Her debut novel, Optional Practical Training, is forthcoming from Grey Wolf Press. Let's welcome Shubha Sunder.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be reading at the book festival of my adopted city. I grew up in Bangalore, India, which is the setting for all the stories in my short story collection, Boomtown Girl. And it's the Bangalore of the 90s, which is the time when I came of age, and in a way, when the city came of age, when it transformed from this leafy backwater, of a town, really, into the Silicon Valley of South India. So I'll read from the first story, Dragon Girl. The girl was the dragon's head. Green cardboard scales, eyes the size of cricket balls, crocodile mouth spilling crinkly orange flames. Inside the papier-mâché shell, a state of perpetual dusk. Gray and cool and slightly dizzy-making. Breath swirling about her ears, fumes of drying fevicol. Outside, a broiling afternoon in a year of severe drought. The closing day of a 6-week arts class. In the vast compound of a British era mansion, before an open-air stage, an audience of 30 or so parents sat beneath a mango tree and fanned themselves with newspapers. An occasional gust of wind set off a drizzle of half-ripened fruit. In 10 years' time, the tree would be felled, the mansion demolished, the city's ponds gone to mud and flies. But on that day, late in the millennium, the mangoes fell by themselves as a chorus sang from behind a bamboo screen. Custard the dragon had big sharp teeth and spikes on top of him and scales underneath. The girl was 12 years old. The mask came down to her waist. With her hands at her shoulders, she gripped Custard by the molars and drove forward. A train of children followed, lined up in descending order of height. green cones strapped to their heads to form the dragon's spiny length. It was the girl's first time as a leader, a role she'd earned by her superior height. In public, her body did not know how to carry itself. The growth spurt that rounded her hips and chest also left her gangly and knobby-kneed. Under the mask, with no one watching, she could lengthen her neck. She could pick up her head. Beneath the blazing sun, the dragon bristled and reared and whipped his fiery snout. When the pirate came on stage, waving his plastic pistols, the girl charged him with vigor, almost ripping the green bedsheet that tied her to Custard's body. Neither of her parents were there to applaud the performance. Friends did not gather around afterwards to say, "Congratulations, let's keep in touch." She had a tendency to shy away from people, her face contorted as if in a scowl. Girls whispered to each other that she thought too much of herself. Boys snuck up behind her and yanked at her braid. "You're bigger than they are," a teacher said when she complained. "Can't you stand up for yourself?" That same teacher, after the performance, might have given some words of praise. "Well done, Mansi. Nice to see you smiling for a change. Have a little confidence and you will go far." But after the adults had clapped and made their way out from under the mango tree, after the dragon's head had been placed in the middle of the stage for all to admire, after a domestic from the girl's household, dispatched to pick her up, had searched frantically all over the mansion grounds, it was concluded the girl had disappeared. "You have to wear a mask to be a dragon?" her mother had joked that morning at breakfast. "You don't look scary enough just on your own?" The mother was a beauty consultant, immaculate skin, Colgate smile, a line of facial creams bearing her name. Being seen in public with her daughter was something of a liability. People shook their heads in amused pity at the walking example of how an attractive parent can give birth to an ugly child. Days earlier at the Bangalore Club, during a wedding reception, the mother had given the girl a hard pinch in the back of the arm. "Can you please stand up straight?" she'd hissed. "Can you please wipe that scowl off your face?" The girl had slipped into a daydream. Her mouth twisted to one side whenever this happened, even when she was thinking pleasant thoughts. "Just scowl a little more," her mother had said at the breakfast table. She put down her teacup and picked up a nail file. "Just scowl a little more and fire will start coming out of your mouth." "I helped to make the dragon's head," the girl said to her bowl of cornflakes. "I did more than anyone else. I mixed the papier-mâché, I painted the eyes, I cut out all the cardboard scales." Her mother ran the file around her pinky nail. "Please, Ma, can't you come? The skit is only for half an hour. Daddy, can you come?" Her father sat down with a rustle of his crisp silk kurta. He had returned in the wee hours from a trip to London and was on his way now to a board meeting at the Bangalore School of Music. He owned coffee estates in Coorg and tea estates in Munnar. He was a chess master and a scholar of Sanskrit poetry. "Sorry, Puttu," he said. As he patted the girl's head, his gold cufflink grazed the top of her head. "Please," she repeated, making her eyes large. "Is this to be a vocation of yours?" he asked. "Acting, making masks, and so on?" "Vacation?" the girl said. "If not," he went on, "next summer we had better send you to chess classes. It will make your mind sharper." "And help in maths," the mother added. She winked at her husband. "Though if she has my genes, forget it. Nothing will help." "Everyone else's parents are coming," the girl said, "but you both don't care." "If you're going to be rude," the mother said, "you can stay at home." The girl stared into her congealing bowl of cereal. She was the dragon's head, the most important role. The kids who pulled her hair and whispered mean things were about to line up in her shadow. And it was her last chance to make friends with the boy. The boy was the pirate Custard would attack on stage. He and Mansi had never spoken to each other until the previous week, when a series of incidents culminated in a strange encounter. The boy was trying his hand at a potter's wheel. The girl was painting geometric patterns on a clay vase, so absorbed in her maze of twisting triangles that she didn't hear the class's worst bully, a hulk of an 11-year-old, sneaking up behind her. The boy watched as the bully yanked the girl's braid. The vase fell from her hands and she whirled around. "You stupid idiot fatty," she screamed and poked the bully's stomach with the hard end of her brush. The teacher, Mr. Krishna, strode up to them. "Shame on you, Mansi," he said. "And don't let me hear you say fatty again. It's not nice to call people names." The girl scurried to the mango tree, shimmied up the trunk, and disappeared into the foliage. Minutes later, the bully reappeared, grinning. He waddled up to the boy with a fistful of clay. "You're in love," he said. "In love with that girl. You want to marry her." "Get lost, fatty. the boy mumbled before he was knocked to the ground and his face pressed into the dirt. Mr. Krishna was attending to the kiln. The bully laughed. Bystanders whistled and cheered. The boy wriggled free, spitting mud from his mouth as he ran. She had never climbed a tree before, but the trunk welcomed her like a friend. Everywhere she groped, she found somewhere to wedge her foot, something to grip. She pulled herself up to the crotch, crawled on hands and knees along a fat lower branch. The compound wall of the mansion passed beneath her. On the far side was a deserted yard, overgrown and buzzing with crickets. She jumped to the ground a few feet from an anthill. It rose to her own height, slopes reddish-brown and steep. "Cobras live in anthills," someone said. "King cobras." She looked over her shoulder and saw the boy. "As if cobras eat ants," she said. "They wait for the ants to build the anthill, then they go in." She imagined the anthill full of cobras, glistening, slithering snakes, cobras oozing down the red slopes like tar, hissing like 1,000 pressure cookers, flowing towards her, winding around her, hoods flared, tongues flickering. "Shall we see," she said to the boy, "if there are cobras living in there? If one bites you, you're finished." She inched forward through a thicket of parthenium and alligator grass. She could have been in a jungle, her first time in the wilderness, with no ayah or driver to supervise her. She beckoned to the boy, who hadn't moved. What would happen if she kicked it, if the slope caved in? Would a writhing black snake emerge? She stood on one foot, and with the toe of the other sandal, she tapped the hillside. It was solid, unyielding. She bent her knee and kicked harder, and a dark hole appeared. She waited. "There's not even an ant," she said. "Let's go," the boy said. "I'm getting bored." "Let's find a stick," the girl said. The boy picked up one nearby. It was heavy and long. "You're mad or what?" He passed the stick to the girl. She held one end with both hands and prodded the rim of the hole. Then slowly she slid the stick inside. The boy clapped his hands to his face and bit down on his thumbs. "There's something there," she said, jumping back. "Something soft, something moving." They waited for it to emerge. 20 years later, the deserted yard and the mansion next door would be replaced by a multi-storied mall where the boy, a corporate lawyer, would bring his 4-year-old daughter to spend a Saturday afternoon shopping. He would tell her how, when he was a kid, this part of Lower Palace Orchards used to be quiet, full of sprawling trees and old buildings. He would tell her he'd once attended summer arts classes here, in the grounds of a crumbling mansion where he learned to use a potter's wheel. He would not mention the girl. He would have long forgotten her name. But he would remember how she looked that day, lunging forward on her long legs like a tribal warrior, about to thrust the stick into the anthill when Mr. Krishna yelled from the mango tree, "You two, get back here, right now." She followed the boy over the wall. "You're brave," he muttered to her once they were on the other side. "I didn't know a girl could be so brave." I'll stop there. Thank you.
Thank you all for sharing those readings. I think just to start the conversation, would love to hear from each of you about the form of the short story, which you've chosen for all of the books that you're reading from today, and why that form for these works, what that does for you, what it lets you explore, and also maybe what you think short stories can do for readers as well. What's the audience experience of the short story that you're hoping for on the other end of that form? Who wants to start?
I'll start because I have a particular love for the short story. So this is my second collection. I've also written a number of novels, and for me, I'm drawn to the story because it's, to me, much more intimate. I feel like you can go very deep and yet keep it small. And I think that we have a connection with stories often as people that goes back to when we're children. We're read to, right? We're read short stories. We hear them often first from our parents, from people we really love. We hear them out loud. And I feel like maybe even there's some kind of memory of that and those feelings that we enter into when we open a short story. We expect to have a certain kind of intensity of feeling. So for me, that's what I aim for when I write my own stories.
I'll also say that I love reading the short story. It's kind of by default and an unfortunate one that I write them. It just seems to be what I do a little bit better. I have written and published a novel. I don't think it's intuitive for me. There's something about the compression and immediacy of the short story. I mean, I feel like the end of the short story happens in the very first lines for me. That's where I start to feel the shape of the story that I'm working on, at least when I'm discovering it. And I do think there's something about a piece of fiction that captures an entire world that you can read, at least potentially, in one setting. It's absolutely unique, and it's an experience you can't get from the longer forms, which also have their pleasures, for sure. But just to be able, on your commute to work, to begin at the beginning and finish that before you get on with your day, I think there's power in that that just isn't accessible in other forms.
I mean, I'll just add, that was Edgar Allan Poe's argument. You know, he has a whole essay where he says this is why poems and short stories are superior to novels, because nobody interrupts you. You can finish them in one sitting, and therefore it's a superior reading experience.
That was long before the tea, too, right? yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
What you just said about the first line of a short story has to contain the ending reminds me of something I once heard a writer describing a short story as, you know, the opening, you know, a short story opens, and it immediately starts closing in on itself, mm-hmm. whereas with a novel, you begin at the beginning and it has to open. So I see the short story as a peculiar challenge. You know, it has to, it starts closing almost as soon as it starts opening. And this is my first short story collection, and I started out by writing short stories, and I think it's a peculiar and very attractive challenge, I think, to really tell a story in such a small amount of space, and not just, you know, tell the story, but create a world. And I love the attention that you have to pay to, you know, every sentence and every word to make it do work for the story. And when it's successful, it's really a beautiful thing.
Maybe just a follow-up to that, how do you know when you have a group of short stories that actually becomes then a book, a collection? When are you writing them all the time and then you see kind of what emerges? Are you starting with that in mind as the end kind of container for a set of short stories? How does that actually work in your creative practice?
I started before. Shubha, you start.
Okay. sure. But when I started writing stories, I've been writing kind of all my life, but when I sort of, you know, committed to being a writer and teaching myself how to write, which was sometime during college, it took me a while to figure out that, I should write about what I feel deeply about. And at the time, it just made sense to me to write about where I was from, which was Bangalore. And so I accumulated several stories, you know, that were set in Bangalore. And in fact, when I tried writing a story set in America, I had a very stern professor who told me, "You're not ready to write about America yet, because there's feeling in your India stories and not in your U.S. stories." And he was right. I just wasn't ready at the time. And then, you know, once I had a handful of stories, I could see a collection emerging. The thing that would hold them together was that they were all set in a place, in one particular place, you know, like Dubliners or Lost in the City by Edward P. Jones. But it wasn't until, you know, just before COVID, I think, that I realized the focus needed to be a little narrower. And once I realized that, you know, really what I was dealing with was a short story collection set in Bangalore in the 90s. So it was not just bound by space, but also time. Then it became a book. And I guess the reason I mentioned, you know, COVID was that I think we all had an awareness of existing in a very particular time then.
Yeah. So, one of the things I lament a little bit is the way we're taught to read short stories, which is in isolation. I think in school we read the great short stories or the classic short stories, whether it's like Bartleby the Scrivener by Herman Melville or, any number of them. Tim O'Brien's The Things They Carried. But, these stories did come in a collection, and I think collections actually have integrity and beauty on their own, just as novels do. It wouldn't be exactly accurate to say that I think about a collection as I'm writing my stories, but I do think that writers have obsessions at different periods of their lives, and that those obsessions and those interests and the temperament of a particular mind can be contained in a collection. A good collection. This particular one came out of, it takes me many decades to metabolize the material of my life so that it can actually become a story, because life is, messy. It's not necessarily interesting, it's not full of tension, and it doesn't have dramatic structure, usually. I grew up in the high elevation desert west, and a very conservative religious background, and I realized at a certain point that I had to escape that if I wanted to be myself, I guess, and certainly a writer. So in my early 20s, I moved to Europe, and I was there for about 5 years, kind of all of James Joyce, right? And it was in the early 90s, a deeply interesting period. It was the first time I really knew that I was an American, actually, and what that meant and what other people saw and thought of when they thought of America. It was shocking to me. I had my first important long-term relationship, learned another language, and I tried to write about that for decades. And it wasn't actually until I went back on sabbatical for a year in France during the first pandemic year, it turned out. In lockdown, I started to be able to write those stories. I tried to write them for decades. A lot of the stories take place and involve the same expats. There's some characters who actually overlap and are in different stories who are dealing with all the things I was dealing with. And something about being back in Europe and locked into a room and looking at sort of the old buildings, the history, sort of brought that period, almost 30 years in the past, back to me and gave me actually the ability to make it adhere to the dramatic structure, and the stories happened for me. And I think that sense of what was bothering me, what was obsessing me, what was in my thoughts and mind was in those stories and in this collection, and kind of coheres and makes it not novelistic, but a kind of kaleidoscope of and patterned coherence. And yeah, that's why I love collections.
I'm so glad that you pointed that out about the beauty of collections, because I agree. I mean, and I sometimes do that where I obsess about one story that I love, and then I'll remember, oh, it's part of this collection. And when I read the collection, I see the arc. I mean, ideally, each story collection has its own arc. And, you pass from one to the next, and you feel a rhythm in the collection. And I'll just say, so yeah, my first collection is unified by, it's a series of stories with interlinked characters. So they recur, the characters recur over 20 years, and they grow up, and you see what happens to them. And with this, I was just writing stories, and after about the fourth story, I thought, oh, I'm writing about similar themes, because as John said, we go through stages in our lives where we're dealing with material, or we have questions, we're wondering about something and think, oh, what if I create a character like I'm doing in the story that I read, right? Who's, what about this person? What would she think about this? And you try to work something out.
Great. Well, I think we'll see if there's any audience questions right now. Anyone have questions for our panelists? Before I keep going, we've got mics that we can run around. Happy to wait. Okay, we got one.
So it came up that the strength of a short story is to be able to read it in a sitting, and then also there were discussions of like being able to group them as books and collections. I was just wondering if you could speak to, in the writing process or the compiling process, what the kind of how you resolve a tension between like connecting those themes and keeping things kind of as a singular unit.
Sure. So I, as I heard the question, it was the tension of kind of connecting themes across the different short stories. And I think, not every short story I wrote during the period in which I was, or let's say, not every short story I wrote between my last collection of stories and this collection of stories went into this book, which is a kind of way of saying that I think what I did and what I try to do is look at the stories and follow the patterns and the themes that I'm seeing in them. And I don't know about Schubert or Daphne, but when the stories started to cohere for me in this collection, I really suffered over how to order them in the collection, you know, and I'm not sure I got it right. I'm still trying to reorder them. It's too late. I reordered them at least four or five times and talked to my editor and then a second editor in my press. And I really think it's important because there are tensions and patterns and echoes, and you don't want too much sameness or consistency. You want differences, but you want enough coherence so that the reader starts to see why these two stories are alongside each other, why the first story speaks to the final story. And I'm remiss at this too. I know readers don't read our story collections in the order in which we order them. Please do. But I don't either. Yeah. So and yet I spent all that time. So I think it's like an album. People don't put albums together so much anymore because I know there's streaming and people just download music. But in the old days, they thought long and hard about how to put an album of music together and what that was and the unity there was in that. What it begins with, what's on the A side, what's on the B side, right? And that, to me, is the process of ordering and gathering the stories for a collection.
Yeah, and I mean, I would add, I will also second that in both of my collections, you know, there were stories where I said, yeah, this is a perfectly fine story. It's been published before. It's not going in the collection. It doesn't fit. And when you start to order them, you know, sometimes, you know, the editor says, oh, this should be the second story. This should, and there are certain, I don't know if you call it a tradition or things that most collections will do. Well, they'll say like, oh, this is generally what people think of the strongest story, or this is the story that won the prize or was in Best American. That we'll make that first. The second story tends to be a story that is kind of different stylistically from most stories in the collection. You'll notice this if you start to look at story collections, right? Because then the editor wants to show, like, this is the other sort of thing the writer can do in case you didn't like that first thing, right? Just so you know, keep reading. So they'll tend to do a certain sort of thing. So they'll usually lay them out that way. And then what happens is then you read them that way and then you go, oh, wait a minute, this weird thing happened where then you had two stories in a row that were about the same exact thing or something. Then you have to rejigger the whole thing. Yeah. I had the same thing happen, by the way, where we had all settled on an order for a long time. It was about to go into production and I had a freak out, yes. You know, emailed the editor, wait a minute. She was like, nope, we're keeping it.
I mean, I think you pinpointed the challenge of a short story collection, right? That every story both needs to be different from all the other stories, but warrants a place in the same book, right? And this, I mean, every book is different, and there can be all kinds of ways to unify a collection. I'd say my book is quite, you know, traditional, or at least I thought it was going to be, you know, very straightforward. You know, these are all stories set in Bangalore in the 90s. And then one of the things I discovered, and, you know, it hadn't struck me until I wrote all three pieces. There are three pieces in this collection that center on the relationship between a Western woman and an Indian man, and I had no idea of this when I was writing the second story or the third. And it was only when I had a bunch of stories and I was putting them together in the collection, I was like, oh. But fortunately, they're different enough from each other that I was able to say, okay, these form a trio, and so they should go together. And I also discovered, and it sounds like partly this was your process as well, that you have to write a few stories before you discover a theme that's holding them together, and then you can use that theme to generate more stories, which is what, that's definitely what happened to me. Once I realized I was writing a collection set in Bangalore, I realized that the characters of the stories that I'd written so far, that far, had you know, tended to be younger people. So then I wrote two stories centering on, you know, older characters to help round out the book.
I think we have time for one last question. Do we have another question out there? Right over here.
I was just really curious about kind of your writing process, like writing a whole novel versus short stories, and if you write a detailed outline first or you just kind of dive in. I was just wondering about that piece of it.
Oh. I think every writer's process is different, right? And I would say every project is different. I think, you know, for there were short stories in here that I was able to, you know, generate more or less the whole story, like within a draft or so, and there were others that took, you know, upwards of 30, 40. I tend not to outline until I have a sense of the language of a story, whether it's a short story or a novel. I have to know the atmosphere, the tone, the language, the sound of it, before I can think about structure.
Likewise, I don't really outline, and it's usually, unfortunately, because I don't know what's going to happen, and I wish I did. I have friends who outline, so I'm not saying not to do it. I have friends who outline the whole thing and then write the book, and I'm like, that sounds so great. I outline after I kind of know what's going on, and I just have a messy draft, and it's to help me keep things in order. I agree with Shubha. It's often more about finding the feel of the story, the tone, and then writing many drafts. Yes.
Yeah, I would agree. I think that an outline, I've tried them, that they tend to just kill the work, because if I know too much about what's going to happen before it's going to happen, I get bored, I'm not interested, and it's just dead on the page. I think there's a way in which you just have to surrender to not knowing. And my process can be, it can be very long, it can be very short. Every once in a while a story just happens for me, comes out on the page, not very often. Usually what I do is I keep a manila folder, and I have to produce a lot of language. And it's just kind of like a mess. It's like, if you will, just like a big blob of clay that, you know, I just write and write, and I start to see some shape, or there's a cadence that starts to happen in the language, and I follow the language at that point. Oftentimes I have to put it away. I just put it in that manila folder. I give it a title. I stick it at the back of the shelf, and if it starts to bother me again, and I take it out, I look at the old material, I see what's interesting, I have some distance, and I start to shape that. And I think that is a process. It's not an easy one to accept, because it doesn't feel like it has a neat beginning and a neat end, but it works, and it requires patience, I think, and a certain amount of surrender.
Great. I like that we have something in common here, which is the kind of openness to what's emerging in real time from the process, as opposed to like the having a very linear, kind of everything spelled out approach. which is relatable, I think, for some of us, even if we're not writers, but other kinds of creatives. So with that, I think we've reached the end of our time. I want to say thank you so much to all three of you for sharing from your books and speaking to your process a little bit. I will say I read all three of them on my commute on the T over the last few weeks, so highly recommend doing that. Please check out Boomtown Girl, The Flounder and Other Stories, and The Archivists and other work by these three amazing writers. And join me in just saying thank you to them for sharing today. Thank you. Thank you all.